I'm going to talk about a specific topic, which is free inflation. And the reason is a number, besides the fact that that's the one I'm most familiar with, is that this is the idea which is sort of best developed. And also, it seems to have concrete predictions to be tested. So for this reason, many people have contributed in this area, and so I'm going to emphasize, or actually pretty exclusively discuss, a particular scenario, which I will call free inflation. Marx has talked about inflation in cosmology, and by now, the observational evidence for inflation is very, very good. And I will assume that inflation is correct, and I'm going to ask, how can we realize the inflationary scenario in the context of superstring theory? That's the main thing. And as I said, the particular scenario we're going to discuss is free inflation, and actually it's realized in a very specific form due to so-called, I would call it a KKMT, which is Kattrull-Kailash, Linde, Maldacena, McAllister, and Tavidi scenario. Because this is very concrete and explicit, explicit as one can hope for. So this will be the first lecture, mostly. I'm going to cover this. And then a consequence of this scenario is that some defects is produced, which we call cosmic strings. So I will discuss a little bit today about cosmic string, but most of the properties of this cosmic string will be discussed in tomorrow's lecture. And in the last lecture, which is also tomorrow, we will talk about detection and test. And that will be mostly about how to test observationally and where to look for and what's the prospect and in general about more phenomenological or cosmological than the first two talks. So for roughly speaking, the first talk is relatively sort of overall picture, while the second lecture is a little bit more detailed, and I would summarize the key points, and for the third lecture, many of the details is not as important as long as you get the bottom line. So that's roughly the outline of my three lectures. So, the way that inflation is realized, and I think Mark has talked about, is in a simple scenario which we call slow roll inflation, which is really the most generic and sort of the standard scenario, although there's other scenarios as well. And in this scenario, what we have is we have a scalar field, and the scalar field is rolling down a potential which is very flat. But it's not totally flat. So this is the potential which is constant approximately. So that means that it behaves like a cosmological constant to the Einstein equation. And for a homogeneous isotropic universe, that term will in general generate exponential growth. So here we have is that A is the cosmic scale factor, and A dot over A is what we call Hubble parameter. Used to be called Hubble constant, but we know it's not a constant, so it's Hubble parameter. And Einstein equations give us that h squared equals to this potential, roughly, plus a curvature term plus density. So density can be a matter or can be radiation or whatever you have. Okay. So what we can see here is the following. If the universe have a V potential, which is more or less constant for some period of time, then this term will dominate because A will grow, and then the other terms become negligible. And once this term dominates, then you find that A dot A can be solved where A grows exponentially. This is so-called the inflationary phase of the universe. Happen for a very short period of time, roughly like 10 to the minus 30 seconds or 10 to the minus 35 seconds. So it's really very, very early, and it's really probing the beginning of the universe. And during that time, we expect, we believe that the universe grows exponentially for some time. And we want that time to be long enough so that it will grow by roughly exponential to the 60. So we call that 60 e-fold, okay? E to the 60 at least. And that's the key, is that during that growth, you can see that the curvature is all inflated away because 1 over a squared is totally negligible, and everything else just becomes totally negligible. So from this point, whatever you have before is all sort of inflated away. Okay? And then the scalar field is going to fall down. So if you have real constant, then you will never fall down. And that's not our universe. So what you want is you have slight slope, so eventually it will fall down. And once you fall down, you get damped, either by damping or by some preheating, which I think Lev Kofman may probably would talk about. Universe get heated, and that's the beginning of Big Bang, okay? The hot Big Bang we know. Now, so from this, we see that at the end, the universe have no curvature, so universe end up as a flat universe. So that's one of the key predictions of inflationary universe. Another, which is very, very important predictions, is something which is called the density perturbation. Okay? By density perturbation, what happens is the following. If the scalar field everywhere fall down at the same time, then you have a homogeneous isotropic universe will remain homogeneous isotropic. However, we know one thing. We live in a quantum world. So in a quantum universe, quantum mechanics will say that that scalar field will oscillate, quantum fluctuate a little bit. So that means that different parts of the universe, it will fluctuate a little bit so that it will fall down at different time. And so there will be slight density perturbation due to the fact that the scalar field fall down a little bit different at different places. Okay? So different. So that little fluctuation you can calculate or you can measure observationally, and it should be give you a result which is delta rho over rho with like 10 to the minus 5. Inflation predicts that because it's a quantum fluctuation, it gives you a scale invariant spectrum. That means that this density perturbation, if you go to Fourier mode into wave number, it will have essentially no dependence on wave number, which means that in this way, the power is zero close to, and that's what we call scale invariant density perturbation. Now, before inflation, it's predicted or it's postulated that if we have no density perturbation in our universe, completely homogeneous and isotropic, then it will remain so. So then there's no chance of structure formation, okay, which we know in our universe, there's galaxies, stars, which is clearly not homogeneous. So what you need is to have little density perturbation fluctuation in the beginning, such that they will grow over time and provide this as a seed for galaxy formation. Okay? Now, that cannot be too big or too small. If it's too big, then things will come very early. Okay? If it's too small, the universe will still sort of pretty much homogeneous. So the number people get is roughly 10 to the minus 5. And also, people would like to have a scale invariant spectrum. And inflation doesn't predict this magnitude, but it predicts the scale invariant spectrum and the fact that the curvature is flat. So these are a powerful predictions because they were made years before observational data come in. Okay? So let me summarize the other benefits of inflation, which I didn't really cover, but roughly speaking is that inflation also solved a number of other problems. Besides the flatness problem, that is that our universe today looks very flat. And if you postulate back, because it goes like a squared, when a squared goes to zero, means that you have to fine tune the universe to be very, very flat in the beginning, like turn out to be like 60 order of magnitude fine tuning in order to get today's universe pretty flat. Okay. And without inflation, this is a problem. But inflation solved that problem, as I explained. It also solved something called the horizon problem. And defects, of course, if defects come like a matter 1 over rho, 1 over a cubed, then a grow huge factors, so they would be inflated away. Okay? So essentially means that the size of universe, which is like a pinhead, will, whatever matter in it, you just take that to make it much bigger, okay? And the density, of course, will drop rapidly. And as I said, because the quantum fluctuation of the scalar field, which we will call the inflaton, that quantum fluctuation gives us the seed for structure formation. And it has a power spectrum which is more or less what Harrison Zeldovich feel that we need in order to have structure formation like what happened in our universe. And this also will give you some tensor mode fluctuation besides the scalar mode fluctuation. So it's a, we'll come back in the last lecture to look a little bit at data, but certainly at this moment is that it seems that the inflation is very well supported by the observation. Now, the question now is that what's the original inflation? Here we have a scalar potential, and where does it come from? And we have a scalar field inflaton, and what is that field? And that's the fundamental question which inflationary universe model does not explain. You just say, once you have that, you can explain a lot of other things. So that naturally the question is that we want to address the question where they come from. And we'll address that in the framework of superstring theory. Not only that, we will actually go more specific to the particular scenario we're talking about, which is that we call the brain world, okay? That is, in a scenario where we have, by now you have heard that superstring theory has a lot of other things which call brains, which we call p-brains, where p is the number of spatial dimensions. So if p equals 1, then it's like a string. P equals 2 is like membrane. So suppose we have p equals 3, and these three brains will span the three-dimensional space-time we have, and this brain will essentially be our observed universe. However, string theory also have extra dimensions, and those dimensions will be outside the brain. So this is the picture of the brain world, is that the three dimensions that span our universe is represented by this one dimension, which is a free brain, or higher dimension, which the extra dimensions have to be compactified. But let's consider a D3 brain, where the three brains span our universe. And then there's outside the extra dimension. There's extra six dimensions, which I cannot draw. I draw one, which we call the bulk. Okay? Now, we also know that there's open strings, which have two ends, and the end of the string must end on the brain. So we have like a photon with two ends, which both end and is ending on the same brain. We can have a W boson, which have two ends, which end on different brains. So you can see in this case that the minimum mass of a W boson must equal to the expectation value, which is the brain separation. Okay, so the brain separation here plays the role of a vacuum expectation value of a scalar field. I should put three of the brains on top of each other, so you can have gluons, which is open string stretched from one brain to another brain, and three of them will form a U3, which contains SU3. We can also now have closed strings. Since closed strings have no ends, then they don't have to stuck to the brain. They can move everywhere in the bulk. So a graviton, for example, is the lightest mode of a closed string. So this will what we call the brain world. Now, this is a very sort of cartoon picture, but by now there's many, many models have been constructed within string theory which have very close but not clear there. They describe our universe exactly, but they have very close features, like the standard model gauge group, like three families, various properties, which can be constructed from string theory. And this is an active area of research that involves many people. So generically, we would just adopt this picture to say that, okay, this is our universe described by string theory, and we live in a free brain, and we can look out to the bulk only by gravitational force. Okay? So this is the picture. So now, once we have this picture, we can ask, what about candidate for inflaton? Now, the inflaton is a scalar field, so we just take the whole model and scan through where are the light scalar fields. Okay, a massive scalar field obviously has a very steep potential. So we're looking for light scalar fields. Well, there's closed ring modes, which are called radion modes or dilaton, or sometimes we call moduli. They may be used for inflation. We have open string modes, and there are two kinds of modes. One is called tachyon, which we'll come back to discuss later. And typically their potential is very steep, so we don't like to use them for inflaton because inflaton wants to have a very shallow or flat potential. So what we're gonna do is we're gonna use the brain separation. So suppose there are two brains, and they are separated by distance, which we'll call the expectation value of phi, which actually is the inflaton. So the brain separation is described by inflaton because the inflaton scalar field expectation value measures the brain separation. Okay? So we call that, we use that as inflaton. And then two brains will have interaction, and that interaction will generate a potential, and that is the inflaton potential. Okay? So that's a rather pictorial, simple scenario of what we expect coming from brain-brain interaction, which generates the inflaton potential and give us a potential, give us inflaton, okay? So I should say that by now there's many other scenarios. Even within the brain-brain interaction scenario, there's many papers, and this is just a partial list of some earlier ones, okay? By now there's many. So the key picture is the following. To describe the brain-brain interaction, we have the following picture. Okay. It's a very simple picture, but captures one of the essence of string theory, or one of the mysterious property of string theory. So we look at the top diagram. Okay, this is two brains. Of course, the brain can be stretched much bigger than this, but or have some other property. But let me just illustrate that. There's an open string which must stretch between the two brains because the end of an open string must end on the brain. So now I draw this picture, the same thing, open string, but suppress the brain. Okay, so we just know that there must be brains there. Okay? So this open string can pinch off our closed ring. So think about graviton. So we can think about, for example, electron or any particle which emit a graviton. And that always happens because you look at a picture, that can easily always happen. And the other reason it always happens is because we know all particles have gravitational interaction. Okay. Now, the same picture, I'm gonna look at this way. Okay, so this is the two ends of open string. And then this open string is propagating. This is time. This is same arrow, time. And as it propagates, it emits a closed ring. So exactly the same process up there, I draw it this way. Okay. So this is like, you know, like you have a sheet of rubber sheet, and then you pull out, you know, a little tube to, and then end up chopping off to give a closed ring. So this is one open string, one closed ring, coming from a single open string. Okay. Same process as the top diagram. Now, well, I don't have to pull this closed string very far out. I can just sort of, you know, bring it back in. So it's really like a hole. Okay? So what happened is that I have one open string, and it propagates, it split to like two open strings, and go back to one open string. Okay? In fact, you can think about this as actually is, you know, following this, it's like essentially where all of a sudden it's split there. So it's open string, go to two open string, go back to one open string. Now, if you draw this as a Feynman diagram, then the Feynman diagram will be something like this, going to this, going to this. It's a Feynman diagram. Now, notice the following. If you look at this Feynman diagram, it's one loop. It's a quantum. It's a quantum effect. But if you look at the diagram up there, this is like an electron emitting a graviton, which should be a tree diagram. So what it's saying is a very important message, is that what open string quantum effect or quantum loop effect behaves in terms of closed string as classical. So This is a key point we're going to use. This is very generic. From this simple picture, geometrically, it's very obvious. Okay? But of course, it has many deep consequences. But here, we're just going to use it for one purpose here. So what we want to do is now we want to calculate the potential or the force between the two brains, because we want to see what the potential is. So here I draw the picture, is that this is one brain, it emits a graviton or a closed string and absorbed by the other brain. Okay, so think about in that way. Then what this means is that it's, from terms of Feynman diagram, is that gravitational interaction between two particles is that if one particle emits a graviton and the other particle absorbs that graviton, then that provides the gravitational interaction. Same is if one particle emits a photon and the other one absorbs the photon, that gives you a Coulomb interaction. So essentially, we want to calculate this diagram. However, notice that this diagram, so if you think about this, is emitting a graviton absorbed by this. But if you look at the other channel, you say that this is one open string stretched between the two brains, and then the open string just goes around one loop. So in terms of open string, this corresponding to nothing but a 0.1 loop open string diagram, okay, or point particle. So we're going to write it, but for that diagram, it's easy to calculate because we have a propagator and no interaction, just propagate around by itself, and then integrate all momentum. And then for boson is plus one, fermion is minus one, and then I sum over all boson and fermion, few degrees of freedom. Now, a string, when you quantize it, give you many, many, many quantum fields. So that sum is an infinite sum. So given the string theory, we actually know what that sum is, and then we can try to sum over that. Or we can integrate the k, or here's nicer, is that I integrate the so-called Schringer parameter, write this as e to the this dt, and then I'm going to integrate momentum k. And that's going to be the expression that we're going to use. And that's the expression typically string theory you see in textbook. You can look at Johnson's book or Kuczynski's book. Usually, the k momentum are integrated out, but replaced by this so-called Schringer parameter. Now, if the spectrum is supersymmetric, okay, suppose you have two brains parallel, then the open string stretch between them is supersymmetric. That means the degree of freedom for fermion and boson is the same. And so the sum will, because of the minus one for the fermions, exactly cancel, give you zero. So that means that if you go to the dual channel, which we can observe as an exchange closed string, that should be exact zero. So you have two parallel DP brains, then the potential between them is zero. And that's a consequence of supersymmetry. Sometimes we call this BPS. But we want cases where there's a potential, okay? Because no potential, you can't do inflation with it. So we're looking at a case which, instead of brain, DP, DP, we actually look at brain anti-brain. So you can think about vortices, which happen in superconductors. And in vortices, what you have is that you can have a vortex, which with magnetic flux point in one direction. If you take two vortices, and you rotate one by pi, then you have vortex, anti-vortex, and they can annihilate, okay? Because the magnetic flux is pointing opposite directions. Okay? So this is similar to this case, that you take a DP brain, and you take another brain which have rotated by pi, okay? Which we call anti-brain. And in this case, the potential is not going to be zero. Okay? So I can try to calculate that potential. The expression is somewhat complicated, but don't worry about the details, because you can say the details, you can look up textbook, and people have calculated. But roughly, so you sum over a whole spectrum of all the modes, or all the quantum fields coming from the string. Then you do the sum, But you first take the brain and anti-brain to be far apart. You know, let's take them to be far apart. Then you find it give you nothing but essentially a behave like this. So in the extra compactified sixth dimension, you will, where p equals to 3, this is 1 over y4. But this is exactly the gravitational interaction. Okay? So if you take the brain and anti-brain far apart, they exchange graviton and give you a gravitational potential. Okay, and the reason it goes like some other power is because it's not in three dimension, but in some higher dimension. So if this is in three dimension, it would be 1 over y, exactly what we know for Newton's potential. Okay. So that's pretty straightforward, as expected. The only thing is that now it's actually different by a factor of 2. It's a factor of 2 bigger than gravitational interaction. And the reason is because they interact not only gravitationally, they also have so-called Ramon-Ramon charge interact by RR coupling. And RR coupling just doubles the interaction. And if I take the brain-brain, what happens is the gravitational interaction is attractive, but the RR interaction is repulsive, and they cancel each other. That's why it's zero. So the anti-brain, they add instead of subtract. Okay? So that's pretty straightforward. So this is good in the sense that the potential becomes very weak as you go large separation. So naively, this is a good sign, because we want the potential to be relatively flat, and for y large, this potential is pretty flat. Okay. Now let me go to a little bit more technical detail to give some illustration of the property of string theory. Again, the detail of the expression is not necessary. You can always look up. But what I want to say is the following. And there's two messages I want to pass eventually, which will be somewhat important later. Okay? That is, if I now, at large distance, I will get a behavior which is just Coulombic. But now let me go to the closed string exchange, because I can do my calculation two different ways. I can sum over the one loop of open string, or I can sum over all the closed string mode being exchanged by the two brains. They will give the same answer. Although sometimes not obvious at all, they will give the same answer. But they must, because they are describing the same physics. Okay? So if I do a closed string exchange, I find that if they're far apart, we do get the Coulombic behavior, but somehow if we bring it close, then all of a sudden the integral diverges. And this is rather amazing. But if you go to open string channel, you can see what happened. Open string channel is that if the strings are, there's a mode, the lightest scalar mode, has the following property. If the separation is large, then you will have a normal mass. But as the separation goes to zero, it becomes tachyonic. Okay, that means this mass square is negative. So this is a sign that tachyons can appear in string theory rather than naturally. So now I can say, let me go to the open string and do the one loop, and I find some expansion like this, where, you know, Q essentially is the minus 2 pi t. T, remember, is the Schrödinger parameter, because we integrate out of momentum. And so we have to sum this. But you can see that the coefficient diverges. So that means that this sum actually, if you just sum, so this is the tachyonic mode. This is when you put y equals zero. And then this is the massive small. This is the first massive level, second massive level. The power of Q measures how massive the modes are. So if you go high, you know, you go to the 10th level of Q to the 5th, then the number of modes is like a huge number, 200,000. That's the 200,000 means that there's more 200,000 more fermionic modes than bosonic modes at that mass level. Okay? And this is, you know, 93,000 more bosons than fermions. So it keeps oscillating wildly, and this sum will diverge. So what we have said is that we can calculate the potential rather easily when the separation is large, but when the separation is getting small, then something is happening which makes life more difficult to sum. And if you naively try to sum it, you get divergences. And divergence will oscillate between positive and negative, depending on how you cut off the divergence. Okay. So what's going on? Well, this is an interesting feature of string theory. So let me go back to take the brain-brain, parallel. Okay? When it's parallel, what we have is that we have a set of states where if I draw the green one are bosons, the purple one are fermions. Okay, so I drop, they're all degenerate because they're supersymmetric. And then I draw all the state degenerate power up. So at each mass level, all the states are degenerate. And the number of fermion degree of freedom equals the number of boson degree of freedom because of supersymmetry. Now, this axis measures as I change, as I rotate one of the brain to bring it to be anti-brain. Okay? Very much like vortices in superconductors. Well, as I change the angle between them, you find the masses start splitting. Okay? So they no longer degenerate, but they start picking up different masses for this one. Every level will spread like this. Okay? The key is that one of the massless field will become tachyonic. And that's why we pick up the tachyon mode. At this end is pi, so this describes brain anti-brain. This describes brain-brain. And this is essentially how the mass of each state will flow as you rotate one of the brain by pi. Sometimes this is known as the spectral flow. You don't see. So what you see is the following. The mass split every single level, but you notice this mass splitting obeys a very interesting property. The property goes as follows. If you take any of this mass sector, which in the supersymmetric level is completely degenerate, then you calculate the mass square and weight it with plus one for boson, minus one for fermion, then you find it's exactly zero for each multiplet. And not only the mass square, this is known as a supertrace, that mass square is zero, the supertrace, weighting with plus for boson and minus for fermion. Mass fourth is zero, the sum for each multiplet, for each set. And mass sixth, sum, the supertrace also zero. So even the supersymmetry breaking is large, a string scale, the supersymmetry breaking mechanism is so-called very, very soft, or super soft. So, this allows us now to sum, instead of summing each mass level, we sum over each multiplet of, which our original super multiplet in the brain-brain case. And you do that, then you get a final result, and you get something like this. Okay? So the potential is the following form. A large separation is Coulombic. Okay? So this is the brain anti-brain potential. A large distance is Coulombic, very flat. But as you come in, Coulomb will actually be very sharply dropped. Okay? But instead, due to all the massive modes, that means that if you're very far apart, then the massive modes won't contribute much because they you are suppressed. But at short distance, the massive modes start contributing. And when you go short distance, the potential really follows this blue line, actually very soft. That means that instead of following the purple line, which due to the massless mode, that the massive mode actually softens the potential. But what's even more amazing is that there's an imaginary part of potential developed. Okay? That means the potential has now become complex. And the development of the imaginary part is very well known, actually, in quantum field theory. It's just because there's a tachyonic mode. So that means that you can use this part to do inflation. And once you get close to this part, when the Coulombic is not good, things fall apart anyway. And we'll discuss what we mean by things fall apart. Essentially means inflation will end. So we'll come back to this point. So what's the picture? The picture is following. It's very hard to draw all the 10 dimensions, so I'm going to draw only two. Both dimensions are in a bulk. Okay. That is, the red dots are D3 brains. So there are three dimensions which span our universe is suppressed. And the bulk is really six dimensions, but I only draw two because I can't draw more than two. Okay. But we need a little imagination to see that the two dimensions here stand for the six-dimensional bulk, and each point of this stands for the three-dimensional space which span our universe. Okay. So let's think about, suppose today, okay, this is an oversimplified picture, but it will capture some of the key geometric points that I would like to pass along. Suppose today's universe is described by five frames, okay, 5D, three frames. Oversimplified, but let's just assume that. Now, remember, if you have a D brain, then you have open string structure between them. So essentially, five brains are all kinds of open string structure between them. And the gauge bosons are corresponding to QCD, SU3, SU2, U1, gauge bosons, and the fermion will corresponding to quarks and leptons. Let's take that for a moment to be the case. A realistic model, of course, somewhat more complicated, but the key feature I want to describe here is still correct. So let's assume that this describes our universe today, and let's assume that today's vacuum energy is very small, which is almost zero, except for a little dark energy. And so let's say that our universe is described by this simple picture today. Then what do we mean by brain inflation in early universe? We meant by adding two extra brains, okay? So I can pull two extra brains. The red stand for D3 brain. The green stand for anti-D3 brain. So in early universe, I can have one extra pair of D3 bar, okay? So the attention will give us the vacuum energy that drives inflation. Because there's attractive force between them, they will tend to move towards each other, maybe slowly, so give us plenty of time to inflate. And at a certain point, when they get close enough, they just annihilate each other. And when they annihilate each other, they will generate a lot of energy. That will heat up our universe to start hot Big Bang. And then as the universe cools down, it will give us back the old universe. Okay? So we'll give it back this. Okay? So this is the brain inflation picture that we have in mind. Okay? Now, the detail, of course, is a little bit complicated. For example, it's possible that the extra brain is very close to the other brains. So the D3 bar will just fall into the stack of D3 and annihilate one of them. Or the D3 is far away from the standard model brains. So those are details which are very important, but we will not worry about them too much at this stage. Okay? And the impedance potential is given roughly by this. This is 2 times the tension D3 brain, which is what drives inflation. And this is the Coulomb potential which will attract them. Okay? So if they're relatively far apart, that potential is weak. And then this is sort of a rather generic, simple, simplistic, but captures the key idea for brain inflation. Yes? D3 has the same tension as D3 bar. Right, the extra ones, right. So, yeah, that's a very important point, is that we have assumed that without this extra pair, this universe is our today's universe. So then you can say, I have five brains, what happened to those tensions? Okay, because if those tensions are there and nothing else to cancel them, then that means that today's universe, we have a huge cosmological constant. But what happened in the construction always happened is that this is compactified volume, so you cannot have just D3 have charges, so charges conserved. You cannot just have D3 charge present there in a compactified volume, which we discussed a moment. So what happened in a realistic model construction, you have something else called oriental plane, which is sitting in a corner, and they have negative tensions, but because they're sitting at some fixed point, that's okay, because they have no dynamic degree freedom, and they would cancel this tension to give us a universe that have essentially zero cosmological constant. So in more, we will discuss more realistic construction, but this is roughly the picture, is that the D3 brain of today that we live in, the brain tension is canceled by something else. Either it's warped or canceled so that our today's universe have zero cosmological constant or extremely small cosmological constant. Okay? So that construction is very well understood, but there's still tremendous amount of QVD going on in this. So that's how string theory can describe our universe today. In fact, many of these vacuums are supersymmetric, which is you've probably heard of. And if it's supersymmetric, then either that the cosmological constant is zero, or in fact, it can be negative, which is we call anti-de Sitter space. So in most construction that we are interested in, we would like to have a cosmological constant pretty much zero. And because of pretty much zero, if we add an extra pair, then it would be positive. That's how inflation takes place. Now, of course, you can have more than one pair. You know, nobody say you have to have only one pair. But typically, if you have many pairs, then they will start another pair by pair, and during that time, inflation will take place. And if the last pair takes a little while to annihilate, then the last pair will dictate the physics that we observe. If you have many pairs, which all of them will sort of fall down in a well-defined way, in a well-particular way that you like, then you can generate that scenario also. And there's some models called assisted inflation, which takes that place. So there's generalization of this scenario, many of them, but this is sort of a key feature. Okay. So let me just write down a formula. So that means that what we're doing is that we are taking this model and we are integrating out the six dimensions, and we will get effective four-dimensional theory where we find there's a scalar field, phi, and we find a potential we call Vy, but y and phi is up to just scale. Y is distance and phi is scalar field in four-dimensional mass, and we can relate by just because of T3. T3 have dimension mass 4, so square root is T3 mass square. So the inflaton really just is the distance times square root of the tension. And so then we get effective four-dimensional theory, and then we just latch onto what people do phenomenologically for inflation and calculate the properties that this particular potential will give us for inflation. Okay. There's a number of issues we have to worry about. First is the scale, the question of scale. We will always take a string theory and then reduce it to effective field theory, or in the presence of gravity, we will reduce to effective Einstein theory. But we also have supersymmetry, so typically reduced to supergravity theory. Okay. So question is, how good is effective supergravity theory for describing brain inflation? Well, the question can be asked in a number of different ways. The first thing you say, well, if you don't have the 3D3 bar, maybe universe is pretty close to supersymmetry, and then using a supergravity description is pretty reasonable. But once you have extra pair of brain anti-brain, the tension is big, because we use it to drive inflation, then why do we still believe that the supergravity effective field theory approximation is reasonable to use? And the reason is two ways we can see. One is look at a scale, okay? So eventually, we're gonna not do it now, but eventually we're gonna plug in numbers. And we find the string scale that required to give us the right inflation is roughly given by M string over M Planck, okay, which is roughly 10 to the minus 3 or 10 to the minus 2. That means we have to consider a string scale which is 2 or 3 orders of magnitude below the Planck scale. And the Hubble constant, which is really drive inflation, is given by this. So the Hubble constant over spring scale is also down by three order of magnitude. So roughly speaking, the Hubble constant, which dictates how inflation, how fast inflation will go, is essentially roughly six order of magnitude or four order of magnitudes below Planck scale. So in that sense, the effective field theory is reasonable. We don't have to describe the physics in terms of full string theory. Another way to see that when we introduce brain type brain is that we have said that the breaking supersymmetry, even the breaking is string scale when we introduce D3 to D3 bar, but the breaking is very soft because the super trace of mass square, mass fourth, and mass sixth all vanish. So it means that the breaking, even in terms of scale, is large, but the dynamics is very soft, and so this allows us to argue that the effective field theory approximation is a valid approximation to use. So this is the picture we have. This is the picture we have now. Give you some idea. We capture what's going on. So the top picture is we exchange a graviton, or RR field plus graviton, which generates the potential we discuss. But I also draw now the tachyon modes. There's two modes which are open string modes stretched between them, and those open string modes are tachyonic. Okay, so something that I have to emphasize, that they are something like that. When they're separated relatively far, that means far means the further than string scale, these tachyonic modes are not tachyonic. They're tachyonic only when the brain and antibrain is clumped. So during inflation, again, I'm drawing a D3 brain, I only draw one dimension because, okay, so the X direction is the bulk and the Y direction is along the brain. So I draw some brain which is, there's no reason the brain has to be flat. The brains can be wiggled, they can sort of cross each other, in fact. Then they can have a lot of defects, they can have a lot of heavy stuff around, and they can have open string stretch between them. But once inflation starts, because inflation just means that the dimension in the Y direction get exponential growth, so you can take a centimeter along this direction, and you just replace the centimeter by a million miles, okay? Then anything in there would be just stretched. And at the end, with a little inflation, then you end up picture essentially that like brains are parallel. So that's why for most discussion, we just consider only parallel brains with nothing in the bulk or along the brain. Okay? So the reason is because of inflation, all density of stuff, all wiggles, all curvatures are stretched out. So essentially, they are like this, okay? And all the brains are empty. So that's the picture we have. So for many purpose calculations, that we essentially start from a situation where the brains are parallel and they just sort of move towards each other. And the reason we can use simplified description like that is because, again, inflation helps us to simplify the picture. Yeah. So everything seems to be working fine, except we have to worry about some issue, which sometimes we have to be a little bit more careful. And that is the following. Here we have the two brains. So in the six compactified dimensions, they're point. So they are like a point charge. So either point mass, which gives you gravitational interaction, or RR charge, doesn't matter. But we have typically a Green's function, and then the Laplacian on the Green's function give us a delta function, which is source. Okay, so this, and the potential is given by tension one, tension two times this Green function. So if I take r prime equals zero. Okay, so this is very standard, we know very well. However, here we consider not the usual case, but rather that the extra dimensions are compactified. So we're talking about charges or masses moving in a compactified dimension. Now, what's the meaning of compactified manifold M? you can think about torus or sphere or any non-trivial manifold if you want to. A compact manifold means that it has no boundary. Okay. So if I now take this top equation and I integrate out the volume, then this will give me just what we know is like the Coulomb's law, but since that there's no boundary, then the right-hand side must be zero because the left-hand side is zero. So what we have to do is, but the integration over the delta function over volume is not zero. So we have to add a piece, which is called one over volume. So that means that this equation is not correct for compactified space. That means the normal Poisson equation that we have been using is not correct for compactified space. Compactified space, we have to add another piece. Here, I just add 1/volume. And now, if I take this extra piece and I integrate the volume, the left-hand side integrate volume, I use Stokes' theorem to keep the surface. Since there's no boundary, this must be zero. And the right-hand side, I integrate over the volume. This integrate for one, because it's 1/(1), give me zero. So that means I have to add a term which is -1/volume in compactified space. This is in condensed matter known as the Gilliam term, or here we just say that consistency required to put this term in. Okay? So the potential we have before is not correct, because before what we have this twice the tension plus some constant over y^4, okay, which is the gravitational interaction. This cannot be correct because we are talking about 6 compactified dimensions, and in order to satisfy the Poisson equation, consistency requires to add a Gilliam term, or in terms of potential, goes like roughly a constant times y squared. That is, the inflaton can behave like a massless field in this potential, and there's no quadratic term, but once you put it in a compactified space, you have to introduce a term look like a mass term. And once you put this term in, then you say originally potential can get very flat if you go far enough. Now what happened? Well, now we have to go ahead and calculate how flat the potential is. And I think Mark Trodden has told you one way to determine how flat it is to introduce so-called the slow roll parameter, which is eta, which is m Planck square of v second derivative over v. Okay, so it's clearly if the potential is not flat, v double prime is big. So this is dimensionless quantity, which is called slow roll parameter. And you want this number to be of order of 1/50 or 1/100. But if you have a Gilliam term, which is required for a compactified space, then that Gilliam term will automatically give you a slow roll, which is roughly 1/3, which means that it's not flat, and you don't get slow roll, and you won't get enough inflation. So if you just have this piece, it sort of screws things up. So I just want to say that the story gets somewhat complicated as we go along. You know, one has to be careful. So I'm not going to go into detail today. I'm just going to give you a very brief point is that eventually we're going to consider a realistic scenario, because we want to have a model where the compactified dimensions are stabilized, because otherwise you say that, well, why don't the 6 dimensions just grow to infinite size to recover 10 dimensions? Why they should be a fixed size, not just grow and stop? And so what you need is to stabilize them, and a particular way to calculate them has been done, which is by these two groups, and using a so-called flux compactification, and I believe some of you have worked on that. And by doing so, what you get is that you get some so-called Calabi-Yau threefold with cycles which can wrap 7 brains, and then there's some warp geometry where I have a D3 bar sitting at the bottom of some throat, and the D3 will fall into it, And while the T3 falls to it, we get inflation. So eventually, when we want to go to a realistic model, we have to go to something which is somewhat more complicated than what we have. So we will discuss that in the next lecture in some more detail than here. But I just want to tell you that in order to describe a realistic scenario, things get somewhat more involved. And in that sense, the physics is much richer than the simple picture we show. Before going there, we want to describe a little bit issue about tachyon, and that turn out requires some calculation to get what happened to the tachyon, what's going on with the tachyon. Okay? And I'm not going to go into detail of this, but rather just mostly to indicate that there's a way to write down some effective field theory which contains the inflaton as well as the tachyon mode, so that we can study the two of them, because once the tachyon appears, inflation ends. And so where the tachyon is when it appears, that means from a normal massive scalar field to become a tachyon, we have to understand that. Okay? And there's some formalism we can use, which is known as the boundary superstring field theory, which can be used. You can use some sort of called superstring field theory to study that also, but it seems that boundary superstring field theory is useful. And it will give you an effective field theory which has both the tachyon and the inflaton field in it. And then we can go ahead and calculate what that potential looks like. Okay. It looks a little bit messy, but it can be done. So I just show you the picture, the potential here. Okay. So this is sort of keep the key potential now. Before we just have the inflaton, now we want to see actually exactly what's going on. Okay. So this is two fields. This is the tachyon mode. The value of tachyon mode starts from zero, so it's symmetric in two sides and increases. And this is the inflaton mode, or the separation between brain and type brain. So here, the separation between brain and type brain is zero. As I go out, the distance increases. So here's the potential. Okay. As the brain and type brain are relatively far apart, they're sitting somewhere at the bottom of this road, and you find that eventually the field becomes tachyon, is very massive, so the inflaton will just go round around this, and because of potential attractive, it will slowly roll down this way. Okay. As you slowly roll down this way, at a certain point, this tachyon field, the T, become massless and become tachyonic, which means that now all of a sudden, the potential in the tachyon direction goes the opposite. So what happened is that the inflaton field will roll along this direction as brain and type brain move towards each other, and all of a sudden you find that you can roll off the other direction. So this is actually proposed within the inflationary scenario called hybrid inflation, which turned out is captured by this brain inflationary scenario. Now, the key point I want to bring in the tachyon is the following. If we have a complex scalar field, and this complex scalar field coupled to the gauge field on the brain, then this is very much like Abelian-Higgs model that we know. In the Abelian-Higgs model that we know, if you start out with a tachyon scalar field, then it will roll down, but if it rolls down, it will also produce vortices. So this model is essentially the same as Ginsberg-Landau model for superconductors, where you find that there's a complex scalar field, in that case it's the order parameter, and then you have electromagnetic field, and together they can produce vortices in superconductors. Here, because of the presence of the tachyon field, and because it can roll down, and because the tachyon field actually is a complex field, then it can produce vortices. So that means that at the end of inflation, when the brain and type brain collide, then you can expect that some vortices being produced. And those vortices is what we will call cosmic strings. So in a generic brain, anti-brain, or actually any brain-brain interaction scenario, that at the end of inflation, you expect some sort of defect get produced. So this is a Billion Higgs model. Mark said he was trying to reach this, but he said he didn't quite get to the defect production. But this is typical thing. You have a potential here, and remember in quantum field theory, if you're high temperature, you will go like this, the potential. As you lower temperature, all of a sudden, a minimum is developed away from the zero value. And then because of this winding value, which is degeneracy of the vacuum, you find that vortices get produced. This is well known, sometimes known as Virchow Newson-Olesen vortices. So here we have a tachyon also, and so generically, just from homotopy arguments, that vortices we can produce. In boundary string field theory, we can actually calculate the mass of these defects, as well as their RR charge, if there's anything called Ramon-Ramon charge. Okay. By calculating those properties, we can see what they are. And turn out the calculation can be quite analytic, which is contrast Abelian Higgs model. The analytic solutions for Abelian Higgs vortex are not known. All solutions are sort of somewhat numerical, approximate. But turn out for the boundary superstring field theory, we can get analytic solutions. And we can calculate exactly the tension of those vortices, and we can calculate their RR charge, and turn out they have exactly the properties that we think a D1 brain should have. So that means a D3 bar brain collide will produce D1 brains as defects. Okay. So this actually is known from some other property, which you know, a K-theory, developed by Ashok Sen, Witten, and others. And it's a very generic property of string theory. That is, if I have dp bar brain annihilate each other, then only co-dimension even defects are formed. That means that if I have dp bar annihilation, only dp minus 2, dp minus 4 defects can be produced. Or if you're familiar with type 2A, type 2B strings, that type 2A have only even dimensional brains. That means the P equals 0 to 4. And type 2B has only odd dimensional brains. So if you have D3 bar annihilating each other, that happened in type 2B theory. And the only defect you can produce is D1, okay? Not D0, not D2. Okay. So those are important points I want to say, that we are producing defects, but not monopoles. Monopoles means the point-like, and not domain walls. Domain walls essentially have two-dimensional or co-dimensional one defect. Okay? And that's very, 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 very important cosmologically, as we'll discuss. So we can see that a little bit. Don't worry about the second part. We just worry about the part. So if you have a D3 brain, then the D3 brain has a U1 gauge field with it, because you can have a vector boson with the two ends ending on the same brain, so you have U1. And the D3 bar also have a U1 gauge field on it. So I can recombine them in terms of U plus 1 and U minus 1. And U minus 1 is the one that couples to the tachyon, and U plus does not couple to the tachyon. In fact, the tachyon will couple to both of them, and I can just redefine my U1 field such that only one of them coupled to the tachyon. Okay? Only one. So the U1 minus gauge field coupled to the complex tachyon field, and that's exactly like Abelian Higgs model. And so getting vortex solution is really not surprising at all. So question now is that, okay, then what happened to the U1 plus? Okay? Because if I have D3 bar, we have U1 gauge field on it. If they're annihilated, the brains are gone. if the brains are gone, what happened to the U1? Well, U minus 1 will just be a billion Higgs boson from massive, but what about U plus 1? Well, think about a picture following. Again, drawing some picture really helps to see where the physics can lead us to. Think about the following. I have two brains. I have a tachyon field stretch between them. I mean, brain anti-brain. Now, I looked at one of the brain which have open string. Suppose there's a green open string with two ends on this brain, and I gently pull it and hold onto it. Okay? I hold onto that open string. Then I allow the brain anti-brain to annihilate. Then what happened to the open string? Because open string can't exist without brains. If the brain anti-brain annihilated, there's no more brains. So what happened to this open string? Well, the argument goes as follows. We have a U plus earlier. Okay? The U minus is Higgs, so we know what happened. But remember, there's another U1, which is U plus. Okay, there's a U plus. So we say that, well, the U plus gauge field now become a confining field. So there's a flux, confining flux. So this confining is very much like QCD confining, but this is a billion gauge field. But it will provide a flux. So the flux will exactly extend between the one endpoint of the open string to the other endpoint. So now what I have is that when the brain is annihilated, I have a flux plus an open string, but together they form a closed string. So just a simple picture tells you something, you know, because I hold onto this open string, it cannot disappear. So, but I know that in the bulk, when there's no brains, the only thing that can really, only string can exist is closed string. So there must be something like this happening. So one can do some calculation and sort of give some support to this picture. So that means the following. That means when the brain, anti-brain annihilated, we produce D1 brains, which we call cosmic strings, because D1, they're one-dimensional. But they can also produce closed strings, which is not surprising. The energy has to go somewhere. And after brains are annihilated, the only thing left behind are closed strings. So they must produce closed strings. And a closed string, massive closed string, can decay, and they essentially provide heating up the universe, for example. Or that means that now what we could produce is the two types of strings. We could D1 brains, which we call cosmic strings, and the closed strings we call fundamental strings. Okay? So they are produced. And of course, there would be tiny little loops, which like just particles we identified. But we are not so much interested in the little particles because they're just ordinary particles. We're more interested in the ones that big, okay? Macroscopic size. So this is where we're gonna discuss, is that, okay, so now we have these one-dimensional objects being produced, and we want to know what happened to them, what they look like, and what kind of properties they have, and we want to say, eventually, how to detect them. So here, we will look into a number of properties, issue about stability, evolution, that means how they're going to evolve as the universe move on in time, and spectrum. Okay? And do they have any distinguishing features that we can tell that may give us a hint of what's going on? So I'm going to discuss these sort of backward and forward, and give you some idea about what these are. And then the third lecture, we discuss, take some of these properties and go ahead and use that for comparison with observations. Before I go ahead, I want to point out a very simple property. Okay? It's very simple in the sense that if you take a string theory, you'd forget about supersymmetry, just take an Ambu-Goto action or Polyakov simple action, and you get an equation of motion, and you can solve it. Okay? It's very easy to solve. And once you solve it, you say, okay, instead of quantizing it, let me just see how does a closed loop will evolve as a function of time. Okay? Think about macroscopic. So the, by far the simplest one, of course, is just a circle. Okay? Suppose I have a circle, that's a solution to the string equation, it's a wave equation. You can do Nambu, Goto, or Polyakov, doesn't matter. And then that string will just shrink to a point, and then go back to a string size, you know, just oscillate between the point to big sizes, no matter how big the size you start from. In real life, of course, that when you shrink to a point, if it's very big, there's a certain point you like black hole, and then it just got frozen. But let me not worry about this at this moment. Now, that's the simplest solution. Next, let me look at a little bit more complicated. By a little bit more complicated, I want to do the following. First is that I have a left moving mode and a right moving mode. Okay, this is so lesson one in string theory is I have a left moving mode which sigma measures the along the string and tau measures the time. So it's sigma minus tau and sigma plus tau. I think these are solutions to the string equation. Of course, the solutions in general, we can expand to modes. I have, you know, sum into modes in both left and right. If I take only the lowest mode, I get a circle. It's the same. But now I said, suppose I take the right moving mode and rotate it in the three dimensions a little bit, and take the left moving modes and add one of the higher harmonics. So instead of n equals one only, which gives you a circle, I add one higher mode. It turns out the only higher mode you can add is the third harmonic, n equals 3. Okay? Because in general, you can have more solutions. But if you just take the left moving with one lowest harmonic and want to add one higher harmonic, higher, only n equals 3. So then you have left-handed, you have the first and third harmonics. And the right-handed, you have only first harmonic, but rotated in an angle away from that, which gives you circle. And then you allow it to evolve. This is just the simplest beyond a circle. And Turok did that in 1984, which is good exercise for any undergrad. And he find that it will evolve in many different ways. Okay? It will just keep evolving, and this is just some picture that he has. And you can just allow evolving, you will, you know, different choice of parameter. And the key point I want to show is that there's something called kink. For example, this is a kink. You can see a kink there. A cusp essentially means that the two elements are tangential, but opposite direction. And they happen, kinks and cusps appear all the time, very generically. Okay? And all sorts of shapes appear. And sometimes they chop themselves off. So this is an important lesson, is that I just give you a simple solution, and then you would do all sorts of really, I don't know, song and dance. Okay? And in general, solutions, which is not just first and third harmonics, can have a lot of other all harmonics come in, then it would be even much more complicated. So generically, they have rather rich behavior. So we want to know is the following. So what happened to them? First, I want to talk a little bit about evolution, because that's one of the important things. I should point out historically about cosmic strings is that, which I would describe a little bit next time, is that if you produce monopoles, then it's ruled out by observations. In fact, it would be disastrous. If you produce domain walls, it would be disastrous. But if you produce cosmic strings, it turned out it would be reasonably okay. It's something that people in the 80s recognized. And so those people say, well, we know the inflationary universe will produce density perturbation, which can provide seeds to structure formation. But what about cosmic strings? Maybe I can have cosmic strings, and they can wiggle, do the all sorts of song and dance, you know, cusp king for a while. And because they're there, they can also produce some density perturbation. So maybe the cosmic strings will produce seeds for structure formation. So people actually think that, aha, now actually I have a competitor to inflation, and let's study that competitor, which is cosmic string. So cosmic string had been studied in the 1980s very extensively, and it has a lot of amazing properties. And so here, what happened? Why does it not a problem that overclosed the universe? The reason is very simple. At some level, and at some level gets very non-trivial, it's the following. Because the dimensionality of cosmic string is one, they have one dimensional, and you have two cosmic strings in three-dimensional space, then the probability that eventually they move and hit each other is probably is one. Okay? So you think about infinite long strings, okay? And the probability they hit each other is one. So that means they tend to interact. And because of these solutions that they try to, you know, self-interact, say, give you kinks and cusps, that this behavior interact will happen, and what they do is they rearrange and some energy release, or two strings will chop itself off, a loop, and the loop will oscillate and radiate gravitationally, or a single string can chop itself off, chop off a loop. Okay? And this mechanism is essentially the strings of chopping themselves up, and then loops will oscillate and radiate gravitational waves and then decay. And this is a way that cosmic strings remove themselves from the density, and because of this mechanism, that it's compatible with experiment. Okay. So this is a key point why cosmic strings, okay. Monopole doesn't work because monopole are point-like, so if the density of monopole is low enough at a certain point, they don't see each other. Okay. So the density will stay there, and then they will grow, I mean, they will go like one, like matter, but they don't decrease fast enough because monopole is heavy. And that's why monopole is disastrous. Domain wall, naively, will also chop themselves up. But it turns out domain wall don't radiate gravitational radiation like cosmic strings, that efficient. So what happened is they really lock themselves up and so-called frustrate, and so the density don't go down very fast. We'll discuss a little bit at the last lecture when we talk about cosmology. But people now can do simulation. You know, you can just generate some simulations. It's not that difficult, but it takes a lot of computer times. So you can take some simulation, generate some sort of cosmic string at the beginning, and then you just let it evolve. And all you need is some supercomputer time. After running out of your time, you look at what happened. And a number of groups have done that. You know, you just find that it approached something which we call the scaling solution. So we'll discuss more later, but the bottom line is that they will approach a density which is a fixed fraction of the critical density of the universe. And that fraction is very small, like 10 to the minus 5, 10 to the minus 6. So much smaller than the dark energy, dark matter, visible matter we see. So here I'm going to describe a little bit about this evolution, because why that happened. Okay. So we're going to do a very simple, simplistic model. We say, well, everything has only one scale, so if I look at the density of cosmic strings, I say it's called mu. Mu is the cosmic string tension over length squared, okay? Because if your point particle goes over length cube, but this is cosmic strings, so they stretch one dimension, so go like length squared. Length is function of time. And I say everything scale with this one length scale to make the model simple. So I have two terms. Rho dot means that rho is the density of cosmic strings evolved function of time. Cosmologically, I have this piece, which is well known, because this is due to the expansion of the universe. And this piece is due to the fact that the strings try to chop themselves up into smaller pieces. So lambda is some parameter. So if lambda goes zero, means they don't see each other, then you can solve this equation, and you find rho goes like mu over a squared, which is what you expect. Okay, if a mass particle, point-like particle, equal 1 over a cubed, if you have cosmic strings that don't move, they will go 1 over a squared. If they move a little bit, we'll go maybe 1 over a to a power higher than 2, but smaller than 3. Still very bad, because monopoles will go like matter, which is 1 over a cubed, which is still not fast enough. However, we know lambda not equal to 0, and so now I can try to solve this equation with lambda not equal to 0. And let me redefine Lt equals gamma t times t, just, you know, it's a matter of redefinition. Then I rewrite this equation in terms of this, which is gamma dot equals minus 1 over 2t, gamma minus lambda. It's a simple equation. Lambda is a constant, time just evolves forward, and gamma is what we want to solve, this function of time. Then you can see, if gamma is larger than lambda, then this is negative, means gamma will decrease. If gamma is smaller than lambda, gamma will increase. So essentially, gamma wants to approach lambda. And so this is the reason why cosmic spring will approach some density, which now, after I solve for gamma approach lambda, I can plug it back in, and I found density goes like 1 over a fourth, which is much faster than 1 over a squared. And for this reason, cosmic spring is not causing trouble. Because if it go like 1 over a squared or a cubed, it would be over close to the universe. So cosmic spring have the good feature that its self-interaction, chopping themselves up, resulting in a density which goes like 1 over a fourth during radiation. And surprising is that during matter-dominated universe, we go like 1 over a cubed. Okay. So at the end is that omega, which means that the fraction of the critical density coming from cosmic spring is something like 10 times g times mu. Mu is the tension, g is the Newton's constant, and we should see again and again that g mu is a very important number because a lot of properties of cosmic spring are dictated by this one number. Okay? And we're thinking about g mu like 10 to the minus 6 or smaller. So the density will be very small. Now, in the 80s, when people want to use cosmic spring to explain the seeds for structure formation, they require this g mu to be a little bit bigger than 10 to the minus 6. Okay. But that threw out by observation. So in that sense, the cosmic spring as the seeds for structure formation is a dead. Sort of rule out by observation. But here, what we are doing now is that we have inflation, but at the end of inflation, we produce some cosmic string. So the cosmic string is not providing a seed of structure formation. Inflaton is providing that, but there's still some cosmic string left behind, and those cosmic string now is what we want to see if we can detect them. If we can detect them, then we can study their properties. And because they're not responsible for structure formation, that they're not ruled out by observation. So what we really require is the g mu to be smaller than 10 to the minus 6. And that is what we're going to discuss more carefully. Now, if g mu turned out to be calculable from brain inflation, and if g mu turned out to be very small, then there's no chance we can see it. Okay. So it turns out that g mu is in a window from theoretical calculations. It's in a window such that it's compatible with present observations, but it's not too small. Okay. It's, in fact, the smallest value is still within the range that can be detected. So that's why it's interesting that we may be able to test this scenario. And the cosmic string that produced are exactly what we know as superstring, in a sense. In superstring theory, we have fundamental strings, we have brains, we have one brains, and these cosmic strings are nothing but fundamental strings and D1 brains. But instead of string to a point, like electron or graviton or quarks or gluons, these things just happen to be produced cosmologically that they can stretch across the sky. So they are not only macroscopic, they're really can be easily galaxy-sized. And yet, they are exactly the same object that make up the fundamental elementary particles in our universe. So it's the biggest possible microscope that magnified by such a huge factor that the question is there any chance that we can detect it? So, the next lecture I will discuss is a number of issues. First is that let's come back to these issues. Is that so far we produce them in the bulk somewhere, and the question now is that can we produce it within our brains? Okay, we live in three brains. Physically, it doesn't really matter because to whatever we want to detect them is gravitationally mostly. But still, we want to know how stable they are such that they can evolve to today. So the stability is a very important question. Evolution also is important because so far, the simulation I discussed and the scaling I discussed are for Abelian-Higgs model or from simple minor model. But we know that cosmic superstring coming from superstring theory in brain inflation is somewhat more complicated or richer, if you want. So we have to discuss that, and that involves the spectrum. But once we discuss the spectrum, we have to go back to worry about stability and its evolution properties. So what I'm going to do is that I know that you people have a student seminar, so I don't want to end any late. So what I'm going to do next time is I'm going to discuss more about stability and the spectrum issues, and we want to see they're not all resolved, but we can get a glimpse of what kind of things we can expect. And then also tomorrow, but the second lecture, we will go and look at the how to detect them, what tests, what's the future. So thank you.